The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is the name of the Honourable James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Urban Development. Does he plan to ensure that future urban development reduces New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions and responds effectively to climate change? If so, how?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Yes, while a built environment accounts for between 2% and 5% of New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions, urban form contributes to some of the emissions arising from transport. This government's committed to achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2050. We've rebalanced transport spending to invest more in public transport in our cities. For example, the changes to Auckland's bus network, funded by our government policy statement, has meant that public transport patronage has now surpassed 100 million trips in the last year. We're reforming the planning rules to enable more quality intensification, and Minister Parker is working on reforms to the RMA. As well as preventing children from being hospitalised, the Healthy Homes Guarantee is expected to reduce emissions by approximately 100,000 tonnes over the next 15 years. Minister Thalesa is working on how building regulation can reduce emissions and updating the Building Act to enable the use of modern methods of construction. And as the member knows, the Climate Change Commission will prepare emissions budgets, including for the built environment.
Supplementary. What measures will he take to encourage local authorities to plan for urban growth in a way that addresses climate change, both through mitigation and adaptation?
Well, we're encouraging local authorities to plan for urban growth, a radical idea. For example, through the Auckland-Hamilton corridor, the government's working with councils and iwi to take a long-term coordinated approach to urban growth and managing land use, setting aside areas of special value and providing transport infrastructure focused on the existing rail network. Climate change adaptation and reducing carbon emissions will be a core part of that planning process.
Does he agree that local authorities should ensure that new housing developments are high density to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in our cities and towns?
Well, Mr Speaker, we are working on reforms to the planning rules that will remove the barriers to quality intensification in our cities, and we'll have more to say on that in the coming weeks. New Zealanders want to live close to where they work and play. And the latest consent data in Auckland shows that half of the growth in building consents currently is apartments and townhouses.
Would he support an obligation for the government's new Urban Development and Housing Agency, Kāinga Ora Homes and Communities, to give effect to emissions reductions plans, future-proofing its approach to development?
So we're taking an all-of-government approach to emissions reduction, and I understand that the Environment Select Committee is currently considering whether the Minister must have regard to the emissions reduction plans of the Climate Change Commission when setting the government policy statement on urban development, and I look forward to seeing the committee's conclusions on that matter.
How will he ensure that urban transport design reduces emissions whilst also promoting more livable towns and cities, especially in Auckland, where road transport contributes 35% of total emissions?
Well, whether we're talking about existing urban locations like the Unitech development or new greenfield communities like those at Drury, the challenge is to ensure that from the get-go, those communities have great walking and cycling infrastructure and good access to public transport. It's only through integrated urban development and transport planning that we can actually reduce congestion. We are going to build Mill Road, Mrs. Collins. And carbon emissions. This government is committed to improving New Zealanders' ability not only to get around their towns and cities, but to reduce carbon emissions.
The Honourable Ron Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the Minister. Order, Ms. Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister. Is he aware that on the back of the New Zealand Defence Force's report on the climate crisis, Defence is currently developing a plan which it will use in the development of its urban infrastructure on all of its bases, and likewise that it will be looking as to how it may better specify new capabilities to ensure that their greenhouse gas emissions are likewise reduced?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I note that the Minister recently announced a review of all of the Defence Force's assets, its real estate and capability, and how the Defence Force is configured across the country for the future. I want to recognise the leadership that this Minister has shown, that Minister has shown, in actually reorienting the Defence Force, both in terms of its external capability and its internal resources, around the future of climate change. And I look forward, as Urban Development Minister, to working with that Minister on how we can take that whole programme of work forward.
Question number two, the Honourable Paula Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by all his government's statements, policies and actions?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Why will only two of the five parties in Parliament determine what question is asked when New Zealanders decide whether or not to legalise recreational marijuana?
Mr. Speaker, the big thing is that we're giving New Zealanders a choice, and every New Zealander can decide for themselves. There is going to be a yes or no question to the referendum. The Regs Review Committee is going to be able to scrutinise the question, Mr. Speaker. It's going to be developed. The question is going to be developed along with the Electoral Commission. So, Mr. Speaker, the fact of the matter is that that Parliament does, through the Regs Review Committee, have a part to play in the development of that question.
How many times has Cabinet...
Order. Which member was that? Right. I'm at somewhat of a loss at the moment, given the fact that we've had so many questions. I'll reinstate the questions that were lost earlier on the part of Ms Collins, and I think the Green members will find that they won't be thanked by their fellow government members for that. Paula Bennett.
How many times has Cabinet alone determined a referendum question without it first going through the House for approval?
Mr Speaker, they haven't.
Sorry, would he repeat that? Sorry, sir.
Well, they haven't.
Oh, they haven't. Sorry. Thank you. So how is it democratic that Labor and New Zealand First get to determine the question when they represent only 55 of the 120 seats in Parliament?
Mr Speaker, the Regs Review Committee, as I said, but the option has been put to the member to join the cross-party group on the cannabis referendum. But instead she sits there playing politics when she can actually be involved in the decision-making.
A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, a minister should give an answer that is consistent with the public good. There is no standing order that would mean a reference of a regulation to the Standing Orders Committee means that that committee would have any say whatsoever in
order,
the question.
Order. The member's disagreeing with an answer. He knows that he can't do that under a guise of a point of order.
Mr. Speaker, but it's accurate.
The member will now stand, withdraw and apologise, and I'm going to reverse the decision I just reversed.
I withdraw and apologise.
Does he agree with Julianne Genta that paying $1,400 is a, quote, small fee, end quote, for a new apprentice buying a Toyota Hiace so he or she can get to work?
Mr Speaker, Julianne Genta is a very hard-working member and I agree with most things she says. The fact of the matter is around electric vehicles, we're going to make sure that we cut our emissions. It's something that those guys over there, when they signed up to the Paris Agreement, agreed to reduce emissions by 30% below 2005 levels. Instead, they had no plan, and under them, if they were still in government, then emissions would continue to rise.
Order.
Why should a young family in his own electorate have to pay up to $3,000 for a car that subsidises people in Remuera to buy new BMWs or Porsches?
Mr Speaker, the member is trying to scaremonger around the whole situation. We know that there is an issue around climate emissions rising. We're doing something about it. That government is sitting over there throwing stones, throwing rocks, when they had absolutely no plan to address the situation.
Okay, we're going to have at least till 2:30 no further interjections from either Mr. Jones or Mr. Brownlee.
Does he expect the unemployment rate to go up or down next week when the ANZ Business Outlook says a net 6% of firms expect to cut jobs?
Mr. Speaker, I expect it to stay close to historic low levels that we've got right now.
Well, how many NEFs has he got off the couch? Or are they now some of the more than 13,000 more people that are on the unemployment benefit?
Mr. Speaker, we've got a lot of the NEFs off the couch, and the PGF investment that we've made, investing in the regions, is creating jobs and is helping to reduce the unemployment levels as well.
Could the Prime Minister explain the regs review process and how it could change the question that's put to it by Cabinet?
Mr. Speaker, the Regs Review Committee is made up of members of that side and this side, and they have the ability to strike out the question.
Question number three, Willow Jean Prime.
Tēnā koe te māngai o te whare.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
The Honourable Speaker, Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, in its labour market preview released this morning, ASB said that it expects next week's June quarter labour market data to show the labour market in, quote, a strong spot. It expects employment growth and labour force participation to lift. As we enter the tail end of the business cycle and the global economy comes under pressure from the impacts of Brexit and the US-China trade war, the New Zealand economy will not be immune. However, unemployment is set to remain around historically low levels, demonstrating the solid fundamentals of the New Zealand economy.
Supplementary. What reports has he seen on the performance of New Zealand companies in this economic context?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've seen recent reports from Main Freight that, quote, the year ended March 2019 was an extraordinary year. Main Freight experienced profits up $29 million to $141 million and global sales up $330 million to $2.95 billion in the March 2019 year. Main Freight identified external factors to keep a watch on, including Brexit, the China-US trade war and the slowing global trade more generally. Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to see a New Zealand company thriving and recognising the important role that staff play in bringing about success against this backdrop of global uncertainty.
I never thought I'd see that member praising a company run by Richard Pribble.
Supplementary. What reports has he seen on global economic uncertainty?
Well, Mr. Speaker, overnight the US Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 0.25%, the first cut since 2008. The Fed said it had decided to cut rates in light of the implications of global developments, including weakening global trade growth, weakening global growth and trade tensions. This follows US GDP data for the June quarter, showing annual growth slowing to 2.1% from 3.1% in the March quarter. Mr. Speaker, it is important to remember in this period of slowing global growth that the New Zealand economy continues to outperform those of countries such as Australia, Canada, the UK, the Eurozone and Japan.
Question number four, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Has he seen yesterday's ANZ New Zealand Business Outlook survey, and does he think the headline grim represents the outlook for the New Zealand economy under this government?
Mr. Speaker, I have seen yesterday's ANZ Business Outlook survey, which said that, quote, the headwinds of a global slowdown were having an effect on business confidence in New Zealand. In response to the second part of the question, as any good economic historian would know, it is not dissimilar to the headlines of the same survey in 2015 under the previous government, which had headlines such as slippery slopes, flagging, heart murmur and below the belt. So, no, Mr. Speaker.
Does he agree with Grant Robertson, who said in 2015, after a temporary slip in business confidence, that it was, quote, a vote of no confidence in the government by the business sector?
Mr. Speaker, I'm concerned about the members' attention deficits, given that the Leader of the Opposition asked that yesterday, and as Mr. Davis said in answer yesterday, that was about the National Government.
Does he think his government policies have anything to do with the confidence in the agricultural sector falling to an astonishing negative 78 at a time when prices are high and we should be doing well?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I know those in our rural sector keep a very close eye on the global economic environment because they are primarily exporters, and what they see there is uncertainty from Brexit and the US-China trade war, Mr. Speaker. We are working extremely closely with the rural community in New Zealand. I noted the endorsement of Minister Shaw and the work that he's been doing recently. Progressive farmers are very keen on supporting this government.
Why does he think a net 33% of firms in the construction sector are intending to cut jobs when there are so many houses and roads that need to be built?
Mr. Speaker, I note that the member is quoting from the ANZ Business Outlook Survey, an opinion survey. What we've also seen is we've got record levels of consents in terms of the Auckland market in particular. There's a lot of activity in the residential construction area, so I think that the actual outturn in that sector will be significantly better than that.
When will he accept that by adding costs to business, creating massive uncertainty and demonstrating incompetence, his government is contributing significantly to the grim mood?
Right, I'm going to get the member to ask a question in order.
When will he accept that his government is contributing significantly to the grim mood?
Mr. Speaker, the only person contributing to the grim mood in the House today is that member, and I would encourage him to listen to his former leader, Sir John Key, who said we should stop talking things down and be optimistic about the future.
If the outlook for the economy is grim, is he the reaper?
Order. No, no, no. Question number five, the Honourable Nikki Kaye.
Mr. Speaker, question to the Minister of Education. Does he stand by his statement that there will not be any more money for principals in this round? And what does he say to the 700 Boards of Trustees chairs who have expressed support for the principals' strike action?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, I stand by my statement that the best way to resolve the issue is for the Ministry of Education and the unions to get back around the bargaining table. I don't think it's in the public interest for me to provide a blow-by-blow commentary on those discussions.
Is he absolutely guaranteeing that no new funding will be provided for primary principals to resolve the strike, given we've heard that before?
Mr. Speaker, I think I addressed that in the answer to the primary question.
What does he say to the Bay of Plenty principal, who was reportedly left in tears when she found out her deputy would be earning thousands more than her under his offer?
Mr. Speaker, I think that I'd say to her that she should convey her concerns to the union that negotiated that offer on her behalf.
Does he take any responsibility for the fact that areas of the curriculum, such as digital technologies, are not being delivered and professional development is not being delivered as a result of the strike?
Mr. Speaker, no, I believe the responsibility for industrial action and decisions around that sits with the teachers and their union, or the principals and their union.
And
order.
Will he absolutely guarantee to this House that he had no role in cancelling secondary principals' collective bargaining this week, which some see as a delaying tactic to put pressure on primary principals?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I can give that guarantee. I had no role in that decision.
Why does he think it's acceptable to have delays in bargaining for secondary principals, 1,900 primary principals striking, principals earning less than teachers, aspects
order
of the curriculum
the
not being delivered, and under his
order,
watch, industrial
is
act...
Oh, no, I'm just going to let the member ask it again. I won't now. Does the member have a further supplementary?
Why does he think it's an acceptable situation to have 1,900 primary principals striking, principals earning less than teachers, aspects of the curriculum not delivered?
Order. I've ruled that question out once and I've done it again now.
Point of order, Mr.
Speaker. Cut the question. When you go back and have a look at the footage, you will see I deliberately, because you had criticised me for asking this question, I cut an aspect of that question, so I'd like the opportunity to ask it again.
Well, the member can ask another question if she wants, but her question was incorrect from the first six words. Question number six, Maya Luby.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Minister of Education and reads, what actions, if any, is the government taking to ensure that the vocational education system meets the needs of industry, regions and learners?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, today we've announced reforms to create a strong, unified, sustainable system for vocational education and training. To pick just two aspects of that to highlight, industry will have greater control over all aspects of vocational education and training through new workforce development councils, and our 16 institutes of technology and polytechnics will be brought together as a single nationwide campus network.
Supplementary. Will this mean big disruption for learners and staff at polytechnics or trainees and their employers?
Mr. Speaker, one of the ways to get the biggest disruption would be to do nothing. That would result in significant closure of programs and courses around the country, which is what we have been seeing in recent times. We've given a great deal of thought to how to minimise disruption of change, so there will not be big disruption in the short term, and any reform changes resulting from the reforms will be well signposted and well planned for.
Supplementary.
Dr. Liz Craig.
So how will he ensure that successful and effective ITPs like SIT are able to continue to innovate to meet the needs of their students and region?
Now, I'm going to ask the member to ask the question again without an assertion in it.
How will he ensure that successful and effective ITPs like SIT are able to continue to innovate to meet the needs of their students and region?
The member's had two cracks. You can have one more to take the assertion out of the beginning of the question.
Sir? How will he ensure that successful and effective ITPs like SIT are able to continue to innovate to meet the needs of their students and region?
Right, that's three strikes. That's the end of that question. Question number seven, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Is it government policy that the topic and wording of referenda held at elections should be determined by government, by order and council, rather than Parliament?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Dr. Megan Woods.
Mr. Speaker, no, the government's policy is to use the appropriate mechanism to set a referendum question. There is no set procedure for setting referendum questions. In the instance of any referenda held with the 2020 general election, the government felt it was most appropriate to set the question through order in council, as there is the distinct possible of multiple referendums. The Referendums Framework Bill provides greater clarity for the public and the Electoral Commission in 2020 by ensuring that the same framework and rules will apply to all referenda that will be held at the 2020 general election.
Supplementary. Does he agree with Labor's statement in 2015 on the flag referendum that the wording and process must go through Parliament with a full select committee process, including public submissions, as it did? If so, why has the government changed its tune and now taken for itself the determination of what referendum will be held
order,
what wording?
I'm going to ask the member to have another crack at that and to get the question accurate.
Supplementary. Does he agree with Labor's statement in 2015 on the flag referendum that the wording and process must go through Parliament with a full select committee process, including public submissions, as it did? If so, why is the government not now doing the same?
Mr. Speaker, I explained to the member what the process of what referenda associated with the 2020 general election will be. But what I would like to remind the member is there will be parliamentary scrutiny of this referendum question through Parliament's Regulations Review Committee.
Supplementary, will the government use this referendum legislation, where it alone decides on the issue in the wording, to include a referendum on abortion at election 2020 noting that the Deputy Prime Minister has indicated that is his preference for dealing with the issue?
Mr Speaker, there are no plans to include a referendum on abortion.
To the Minister, can he confirm that under this legislation, the government would have the power to have a referendum on New Zealand becoming a republic, abolishing the Maori seats, euthanasia, cannabis, abortion, or anything else it decides? It's an important issue, Mr Speaker.
Oh, well, the member can have another crack. It's another question, though.
Can he confirm that under this legislation, the government would have the power to have a referendum on New Zealand becoming a republic, getting rid of the Maori seats, or anything else it likes, without Parliament or the public having any say?
Mr Speaker, I think the member is getting ahead of himself. The situation that we have outlined is that there is the possibility of multiple referenda. We have, of course, publicly discussed that we are in an unusual situation that we're needing to negotiate, and there is also the possibility of a referendum on David Seymour's End of Life Choices Bill. The member can put up a whole lot of hypothetical scenarios, but of course any government could legislate for any referendum, so I think the member's getting ahead of himself.
Well, Mr Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, my question was whether he can confirm that under this legislation we're debating, the government could have any of those referenda. The Minister, did not answer that question.
And it was a hypothetical question, and it was certainly addressed. Question number 8, Dr Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Education, does he stand by all his statements, policies and actions around the reform of vocational education?
Mr Speaker, yes, in the context in which they were made.
Supplementary. How many jobs will be lost from industry training organisations when the government's own website Education Central states most of the 1,300 full-time equivalent staff in the ITOs will lose their jobs under the new plan?
Mr Speaker, the website does not state that. 1,300 people work for ITOs in total. Some of them may find their jobs are affected. They might find that they're working for a different organisation. But to suggest that all of them would overnight lose their jobs is just scaremongering.
Supplementary. How many jobs will be lost from the polytechnic sector, given the Minister told TV programme The Nation earlier this year that the reforms would cause significant job losses?
Mr Speaker, again, that is not what I said on The Nation earlier this year. What I said was that there will be change, that the change will be well managed, that there is not a target for job reductions. In fact, we want to see this sector expand, which is not what was happening under the policies adopted by the last government.
Dr Liz Craig.
Does he stand by his statement that ITPs like SIT will be able to continue to innovate to meet the needs of their students and region?
Mr Speaker, yes, I do stand by that statement, and the commitments that we've made, including ring-fencing the cash reserves of ITPs that have significant cash reserves so that they can be reinvested back in their local communities, is one of the ways that we can help to ensure that.
Will polytechnics like SIT, with the ring-fenced cash reserves the Minister has just talked about, have final decision-making on how those reserves will be spent?
Mr Speaker, the way the institution will operate, the operating model of the institution in the longer term, has not yet been determined.
Supplementary. Will polytechnics like SIT, UTA, Otago, NMIT and UCOL have the final say on what they teach and how they teach it?
Mr Speaker, the decision-making structure of the new institution has not been determined.
Oh, it's a no. There's the answer right there.
Question number 9, Jenny Marcroft.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development and asks, what progress, if any, is being made on Provincial Growth Fund projects across the country?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Speaker, the
Order.
Question...
No one asked me. Shane Jones.
The question requires a very focused response. Two projects in particular stick out where the New Zealand government approach, unlike the other side, is fiscal sprinkling on provincial seabeds in the form of the Tairawhiti roading package, because we are a pro-road government. We have dedicated $137 million, and the Rākaitāne road upgrade shows great progress has been made by working round the clock. And to demonstrate the flexibility, sir, in the regions in relation to transport, $40 million for a capacity increase in relation to the Transalpine, an overdue addition to the products in the services in the tourism sector.
Supplementary. What are some other projects making good progress?
Mr. Speaker, despite the verbal spray from the other side of the House, Invercargill is going to receive overdue attention. Sir, great strides are being made in that part of the country, despite the misrepresentation about a certain politic. $1 million has been allocated for inner city development, and subject to quality leadership and an engagement between the government's imagination and the ambition of the South, we'll see more progress there. And the Tairawhiti, sir, I say no more than the single young woman on the forestry course saying it has been a life changer for her and her people, training on the ground, dedicated to transforming the lives of those communities blighted by the previous 9 years.
What feedback has he heard from the regions?
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker, you've been quite firm today in preventing questions being asked that had any degree of colour to them, and similarly asking questions that had any degree of list to them. The answer that was just given by Mr. Jones had not only colourful comment in it, but also potentially derogatory. And also, then he went on to give a very long list. Now, given that he's being asked the question by one of his own people, it's surprising he has to do that. But it would be pleasing for us if there could be some consistency in the rulings on questions and answers.
All right. Thank the member for his request. Jenny Marcroft.
Supplementary. What feedback has he heard from the regions about this good progress?
Mr. Speaker, what a leading identity from the New Zealand Renaissance economic community, Mr. Mike Williams, who has stated on behalf of Howard League that if you live in a small rural community and you have family members coming out of the Hinaki, giving them a licence, something that the last regime refused to provide the money for to this organisation, is a life changer. Sir, and Mr. Meng Foon, a long-term advocate for that part of New Zealand, otherwise known as the Tairawhiti, whose voice became hoarse as he sought to attract attention from the last regime, and now his prayers have been up.
Okay, that's enough. Thank you.
Question number 10, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, when will she be announcing which 26 or 27 of the 42 Welfare Expert Advisory Group recommendations she has commissioned work on, and are these in addition to the three announcements on the 3rd of May 2019?
The Honourable Mr. Speaker. Cipollone, I have been warned this is a longer than normal answer.
On May the 8th, Minister Henare responded to a similar question, citing a then up-to-date list of the recommendations from the Welfare Expert Advisory Group where work was already underway and other recommendations for which work had been commissioned. Since that announcement in the House, the member will be happy to know that further work is now underway to help address recommendations 6, 18, 21 and 29, and work has been commissioned on a further five recommendations. These are 1, 2, 4, 24 and 31. This brings the total number of recommendations where work is underway to 19, including announcements made on the 3rd of May and recommendations where work has been commissioned to 10. We will continue to commission work and consider all of the other recommendations as we develop our 3 to 5 year plan that will sensibly address recommendations in the report through a systematic overhaul of the welfare system that is effective and enduring and that ensures those who need to access MSD support are actually better off.
Very thorough.
Supplementary. Is the government considering changing the principles of the Social Security Act, which includes the principle that, quote, work and paid employment offers the best opportunity for people to achieve social and economic well-being, closed quote.
Mr Speaker, the overall phase two of the plan is something that the member will have to wait for. I've already announced in the House that that will be something that we will discuss more fulsomely and publicly later on in the year. But with regards to the principles and the way in which they could potentially guide our system better than what we've had in the past, I think all of us should be open to considering those things. On this side of the House, we're very focused on making sure that those that need financial hardship support get it, but that also they get support to go into meaningful and sustainable employment.
Supplementary. Why did the government decide to index benefits to wages rather than CPI?
Mr Speaker, that's a very good question. The answer to that question is that clearly wages have increased at a higher rate, greater rate, than what they have to CPI. And so this is an indication of the fairer welfare system that this government is committed to. We don't want to see people thrown into further hardship. We don't want New Zealanders who access the welfare system to be left further behind. It was a very important systematic change and something that I and this side of the House are very proud of.
Supplementary. If indexing benefits to wages means an extra $11 per week per family on average by the 1st of April 2023, how much would CPI have provided in comparison?
Mr Speaker, it would have provided less, but I don't have that actual figure in the House, and if she wants to put it in writing, I'd be more than happy to respond to that.
Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
What work, if any, is underway to address recommendations related to Māori and the welfare system?
Mr Speaker, around a quarter of MSD staff and over one-third of MSD clients are Māori. Getting things right with and for Māori is important to the whole of the Ministry of Social Development. So we rolled out Te Pai Tata, MSD's Māori Strategy and Action Plan. It focuses on earning the respect and trust of Māori, forming genuine partnerships with Māori and supporting Māori aspirations. Māori reference groups have been actively engaged in the rollout of our front of house design changes, and we continue working on things like engagement plans for iwi, new models of case management and reviewing the procurement of services to better meet the needs of Māori. This is not a tick box exercise for us. This is about systematic change and genuine ongoing engagement, and we are committed to doing the work and getting it right.
Supplementary. What is CPI?
Consumer price index. Thank you very much, member.
Well, yeah, no, we will keep going, but I'm just contemplating the quality of that. Question number 11, Chris Bishop.
Oh, thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Transport, does she stand by all her statements, policies and actions?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
On behalf of the Associate Minister, yes, in their original context.
Supplementary to the Minister, has she or her staff talked to the Minister of Transport, Phil Twyford, or his staff about the release of her 26 March 2019 letter to him?
On behalf of the Associate Minister, yes. We talk about almost everything in relation to the transport portfolio, including requests for correspondence that passed between us.
Does she think her letter to Phil Twyford of 26 March 2019 had any influence on the final Let's Get Wellington Moving package agreed by Cabinet? If so, what was that influence?
On behalf of the Associate Minister, the way that we run the transport portfolio is to have a frank and robust exchange of views on all these things. And I'll say this about the Minister, he doesn't always agree with the views of the Green Party. He often doesn't agree with his own officials, but he does make sure we have a frank exchange of views to inform the best possible decision-making.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. That was a very specifically worded question about influence on the final package that went to Cabinet. There was a lot of material there about robust conversations, but not a lot about whether or not the Minister, the Associate Minister, considered that her letter had any influence on the Minister and the final Cabinet consideration.
Yeah, I can see what the Member's getting at, but I think the question was addressed.
Does her 26 March 2019 letter to Minister Twyford implicitly or explicitly refer to her considering her position as a minister if the project sequencing in the draft Cabinet paper went ahead?
On behalf of the Associate Minister, no, not in any way.
Supplementary, what is her response to Darren Ponter, Chair of the Wellington Regional Council Sustainable Transport, or Deputy Chair, sorry, of the Wellington Regional Council Sustainable Transport Committee, who said this morning, let's see what it is she had pushed for and the direction that she has changed, because the things that have arrived on Wellingtonians' plate in relation to Let's Get Welly Moving are certainly not the things that they identified as projects they wanted when it went into the parliamentary process.
On behalf of the Associate Minister, no, I disagree with Darren Ponter. I think he's suffering from election fever. I agree with the comments of Wellington City Mayor
order,
Justin Lester.
Order. I think there's two points that I want to make. First, to remind the Minister answering the question, he's answering it on behalf of another Minister and should be using her voice as he does that. And the second point is the Minister should be careful about reflections on persons outside the House who cannot answer.
On behalf of the Associate Minister, I don't agree with Councillor Darren Poynter, but I do agree with Mayor Justin Lester, who said that Wellingtonians wanted to get on with the project and that's what they're doing. And in response to the second part of the member's question, the overwhelming tenor of the public responses to the public engagement carried out for Let's Get Welly Moving was that the people of Wellington wanted to see a project that delivered walking and cycling, rapid transit, public transport. We've landed a $6.4 billion transport investment that will unlock the growth potential of this city, something that that party failed to do for 9 years.
Supplementary. When she quoted the Ombudsman's comments about political consultation yesterday as a rationale for not releasing her letter to Minister Twyford, was she implying she wrote that letter not as an Associate Minister of Transport, but merely as a Green Party MP?
On behalf of the Minister, no. It's the convention of government that letters between ministers and indeed letters between governing parties are not released, and we don't intend to change that convention.
Well, I'm prepared to let the member have another question.
Is she seriously saying to the House that letters between ministers about matters such as a $6.4 billion 20-year-plus transport project for Wellington are not, by convention, released for public comment and consideration?
On behalf of the Minister, what I was saying when I cited the Chief Ombudsman's recent opinion on political consultation is that political consultation is vital to good governance and good decision-making, and that's even more the case in the MMP era, and that's what the Ombudsman said.
Well, can I have another one, Mr. Speaker?
Well, you're allowed another one, but you're probably... I've given you one extra. Question number 12, Andrew Warren Clark.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker.
My question is
to the Minister of Health and asks, what progress, if any, is the government making on ensuring New Zealanders have safe drinking water?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, all New Zealanders have the right to expect their tap water to be safe to drink. We know from the experience in Havelock North in 2016 where 5,000 people got sick, then unfortunately this has not always been the case. Yesterday, the local government minister and I were pleased to announce approval for a dedicated water regulator to ensure we can have confidence in the safety of our drinking water. This was one of the key recommendations of the Havelock North Inquiry Stage 2 report.
Supplementary. How will a dedicated water regulator prevent outbreaks of waterborne disease like the Havelock North outbreak from happening again?
Mr. Speaker, for too long, drinking water quality and safety has been covered by a number of pieces of legislation, and responsibilities have been split between a number of agencies. As a result, oversight has been fractured and ineffective. The new regulator will ensure coherent oversight of the entire drinking water supply system. They will also ensure compliance with standards through monitoring and enforcement. And furthermore, they will provide leadership to the sector, help build capability, provide information, advice and education, and report on the performance of the sector.
Supplementary. What powers will the new water regulator have?
Now, Mr. Speaker, the new water regulator will have the final say on drinking water. Its powers will be set out in the new Water Services Bill the government intends introducing this year. This legislation will clearly set out all of the obligations to suppliers to provide safe drinking water to their communities. It will strengthen the compliance, monitoring and enforcement of drinking water regulations. Mr. Speaker, this is a critical milestone for drinking water safety in this country.
That concludes oral questions.